pub quiz question time. From which 1983 arcade game does this piece of music originate? And while you're mulling that over, let me tell you, my friends at Beer 52 are offering you, the listeners of My Perfect Console, a free case of 8 new and exclusive beers. Beer 52 offer the ultimate beer discovery experience. This month, they're showcasing the world's best independent breweries with an exclusive selection of beers from 8 different countries, including Germany, Belgium, and the USA. Simply go to www.beer52.com/perfect and you'll only have to pay £5.95 postage to get 8 unique beers delivered right to your door. In the box, you'll also find a couple of tasty snacks and a copy of the award-winning Ferment magazine, in which you can learn all about the fantastic breweries featured in the case of beer that you receive. And even if after all that you're still unsatisfied, you simply pause or cancel at any time. So that is www.beer52.com/perfect to claim your free case of independent, delicious craft beer. And the answer is, of course, the arcade game in which you play as a barman, Tapper.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
My guest today is an English author and journalist. He grew up in a town near Stockport in Greater Manchester, then studied English and drama at Warwick University. After graduating, he joined Big Red Software, testing Game Genie codes for the Game Boy and coming up with names for the vehicles and tracks in Big Red Racing. In 1995, he joined the team of the recently launched Edge magazine as features editor, before becoming editor of the unofficial Dreamcast magazine, DC UK. In 2005, he assumed the pioneering role of games editor for The Guardian, a position he held for more than a decade as one of the first long-term beat reporters on games for a broadsheet newspaper. In 2016, he published his first novel, A Boy Made of Blocks, based on his experience bonding with his autistic son in Minecraft. After the book became a Richard and Judy bestseller, more followed, and he is now publishing his fourth novel, Love is a Curse, a story about generational love and trauma. Welcome, Keith Stewart.
Hello, Simon. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Keith. Thanks for coming on. So, I've had people on here who I consider to be friends before, but you're the first person on the podcast who literally has sleepovers at my house.
Thank you so much for your reasonable accommodation.
So yeah, you stayed over a few weeks ago. I should say, you know, just like a, in a friendly friendship way, when you come over for dinner and you hang out, it's not like we're lovers or anything, but not yet. a few weeks ago we finally managed to get to Chichester Cathedral near where I live to see the Arundel tomb, which we've been trying to do for ages, haven't we? Because you're a huge fan of the Philip Larkin poem based on this effigy they've got there of a 14th century knight and his lover holding hands. Give us a blast of that poem, Keith.
I can give you the closing stanza. Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their final blazon and to prove our almost instinct, almost true. What will survive of us is love.
There we go. Off the top of the head. And for the listener, I didn't even give Keith a heads up. I was going to ask him to do that. I had faith.
I can remember the first time I studied Larkin for A-level, and I can remember that book first being read out by our English teacher and the whole class of 18-year-olds just suddenly going silent. It was quite a magical moment. So,
now, I thought it was a good place to start because your new book's all about cause and effect of love, you know, in life and then also after we're gone. Was the poem an inspiration in any way?
Weirdly, I think Larkin has kind of inspired me throughout my career because he writes in such a kind of plaintive, morose way about like beautiful feelings. And he's often misunderstood as kind of poetry's Morrissey. But he was... like he wanted to be cynical, I think, but he had love and he was loved. And I'd like the tension between this morose, bespectacled character and these emotions that he was dealing with and hiding that could only come out through poetry. So I definitely feel like I reread The Wits and Weddings quite a lot. And so, yeah, I think it was definitely partly an influence, that and Gothic literature is a massive influence on me.
Right, yeah. Well, give us what's the elevator pitch for the book then, Love is a Curse?
I haven't done an elevator pitch yet. It's quite complicated. I think it's a story about a young woman whose favourite aunt on her deathbed tells her that the family is cursed and that she can never fall in love because something terrible will come for her if she does. And her aunt is an artist and a kind of eccentric, so she takes this as a kind of a weird anti-patriarchal warning. But then she does fall in love with her boyfriend, and as soon as she admits to herself that she's in love, within a few hours he's involved in a serious car accident and ends up in hospital. And she thinks, oh my goodness, the curse is true. Now I've got to get to the heart of what this thing is to see if I can save myself and save my boyfriend. And that's it. It's a journey to the heart of an ancestral curse, going through the generations of a family and seeking the source. So, yeah, very, very gothic, but with sort of twists.
Very good. I'm exiting the elevator and I'm calling up Amazon as we speak.
To order. Excellent.
Or rather an independent bookshop.
Well, of course.
That I can order from. So, like, you know, generational trauma is something that our current generations, I think, are examining in a way that I think previous generations didn't. I think that's a generalization, but I think it's probably completely true. And, you know, the adverse experiences that affected our grandparents, you know, and how they trickle down in patterns of behavior and ways of being. Did, you know, writing this book cause you to examine of any of that stuff in your own lineage?
A little bit, yeah. It's interesting because I don't know huge amounts about my father's family, but what I do know was that my grandfather was a policeman during the war, the Second World War, and I wonder about some of the horrors that he probably saw on the bombed out streets of that city. And on my mother's side, my family all come from Widdy. They actually all come from Haworth. And one of my ancestors is buried in the cemetery outside the Bronte Parsonage. There's that kind of, I think there's sort of a bleakness that I really love in literature and in films. And I wonder if that kind of comes from my ancestors in Yorkshire, in this little bleak town of Haworth in the Victorian era, when it was like windswept and the Brontes were wandering the streets looking pale and sickly.
Yes, I mean, we've both written about the Second World War, you know, you in fiction, me in non-fiction, but it's, you know, you mentioned there your grandfather being a police constable during the war?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just the 20th century trauma, isn't it, for that generation, I think, who were already experiencing, I guess, in the 30s, having had Victorian era parents maybe, and already all of that change, and then the war happens and there's just this collective global trauma that they, and then all the anger in the 60s and 70s that they had with their boomer children.
Yes.
You know, that seems like a very common pan, doesn't it?
I think so. And I think we're going to see it again with COVID. I think COVID's going to have an ancestral knock-on effect. I think, you know, it knocked out 2 years of people's lives. And to those of us in our kind of middle ages, you know, that's 2 years that we couldn't afford to lose, but we could afford to kind of almost look over and get through. But, younger people, children, teenagers, I think that's going to have a really firm effect on their lives growing up, on the way they form relationships and maybe even the relationships they form with their children. So, and I think that's what I was really interested in with Love is a Curse, the way that Oz can be against us psychologically, even before we begin. And I read lots of kind of surveys and research into ancestral memory and how the children and grandchildren of the Jewish inhabitants of the Nazi concentration camps have inherited some of that fear and trauma and horror. And, you know, it comes out in their characters and their psychology. And I just think that's kind of fascinating and also, you know, quietly, desperately depressing. I got kind of really interested in how much of our personality is down to things that happened years and years and years before we were born and has worked its way into like our DNA.
Yeah, yeah. It's so true about the pandemic. You just think, and similarly with the Second World War and the First World War before it, this idea that almost overnight reality can completely change. And if you live through that as a young person, that's always going to stay with you. The thing that you just lose your sense of constancy or the illusion that, reality is a fixed thing and consistent and actually it could just change overnight. And then that's surely going to affect the way that people who are 16, 17 years old now are going to parent their children in 20 years' time. And that's how it goes on and on.
I think so, yeah. And I also feel like events like that really test our belief in the idea of consensual reality. And like, are we all sharing the same space? And I think so many people went through very different types of trauma and worry during lockdown. And we all think it was a shared experience. But I think in a lot of ways, we all had our own kind of separate understanding and worries about what was happening in the world. And some of the things that we thought were permanent about life, we rediscovered weren't. And I think that's a real shock, like a psychological shock that I think is going to take, you know, it takes years and perhaps we'll never really understand the effect that that's had. I wonder how much it kind of tests our understanding of consensuality in the, you know, in our understanding of how the world works, because so many systems we rely on broke down.
Yeah, and it's, I suppose, entertainment as well can form a little sense of that is a patch that can be a shared reality, right? We all played Animal Crossing over, or not all of us, but like many, many people around the world played Animal Crossing over the lockdowns. You know, we all kind of maybe watched The Last of Us TV series last year or whatever, and there are these patches that allow us to bond,
yeah,
and perhaps shore up that idea that we're all going through the same things at the same time.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the kind of wonderful and kind of semi-ironic things about video games during the lockdown, that they did provide an anchor for a lot of people. Like when everything else was melting away and breaking and stopping, you could go into Animal Crossing and have a tea party. And I had these amazing stories about, I've forgotten what it was, there was a book publisher that was doing a lot of its editorial meetings in Red Dead Redemption 2.
No.
Yeah, really? And I love the idea of these people, you know, discussing what was going to be on their publishing slate for the next 2 years while dressed as cowboys gathered around a virtual fire. I think that's really interesting. People think of video games very much as an other space, as an almost an isolation, a form of isolation. But for 2 years, it was the place where you could meet people and get together. It garnered a sort of reality that's never really had before, I think.
Okay, well, let's turn to that. I mean, that we went in pretty hard there, Keith, but...
Yeah. not messing around.
Not messing around. Okay, let's turn to the premise of the podcast. I've asked you to pick the five video games you'd like to put on your ideal fictional games machine. I love the games you've picked. Oh my gosh. So going to really enjoy talking about these. But we're going back to 1984, a time pre-pandemic. Tell us about this one. What's the game and why do you love it, Keith?
The game is Impossible Mission. A platform adventure game in which you play an unnamed secret agent who is infiltrating the lair of a mad professor named Elvin Atombender. And so good. And,
based on Oppenheimer, I guess.
Yeah, of course. yeah, absolutely. And he's suspected of hacking into national security computers. So you've gone into his lair, and it's 2D visuals. And you go into each of the rooms and you have to try and find puzzle pieces of his secret code in order to assemble them into a jigsaw-like code breaker and then into the code to blow up his computer. It was such a stylish game. I can remember first seeing the review of it in Zap 64, the big Combo 64 magazine at the time. I just thought the visuals looked amazing. And it wasn't like they were super detailed or anything. It's just that the game has a real kind of sense of its own aesthetic. A lot of video games in the 80s, and I've been playing video games, you know, since like 80, 81, they were either trying to ape arcade games or they were just... People didn't really have, like, a lot of game developers, really very young men, didn't really have any sense of the aesthetic preference. But this was such an aesthetically strong game. Its use of big blocks of colour, its use of domestic furniture, beautifully, the beautiful composition of space within each level. And it's just, basically every single level is kind of patrolled by these robots, but all the robots have different behaviours. Some will follow you. Some have a set path, but you never know until you get into the room, and all the rooms are procedurally generated. You never know until you get into the room which robot has which behavior. So there's all these jump scares in it as well. And obviously, it was really famous for its using speech as well. It had computerized speech.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the only other person who's picked this game so far is Dara O'Brien. And when he was on here, he did an impression of one of the famous lines. Do you want to give it a go?
Yeah, I mean, I know all the lines, so I can do that. I'll do the first one.
Okay.
And now the visitor, stay a while, stay forever.
There you go. That's the one Dara did as well.
3 years of drama training there.
Cast him immediately.
Yeah. But yeah, it was so good. And even like the blood curdling, when you could, if your character was hit by a laser or a robot or fell down a hole, he had this really blood curdling scream, and that was digitized as well. And it sort of went, ah! And it went on for ages. And he really felt guilty for accidentally killing him. But yeah, it was just loaded with these kind of little... The sound effects were amazing. The sound of your feet tapping on the steel surfaces of the floors and the sounds of the machines, the computers. It was all just so atmospheric. And it was very... I just feel that... What's actually interesting to me is the coder, Dennis Caswell, who worked on a few games in the early 80s, but then moved out of games and into aviation software. He's now a published poet.
No way.
I think he's like 4 books of poetry. And I just feel there was something really poetic about this game in the way that it was so strongly visualized and so well balanced and composed that it doesn't surprise me in a way that he's gone on to be a poet. And he did the whole thing himself in Assembler and designed the levels on graph paper, which is what I did when I was in my teens. I designed Dragon 32 games and I designed all of the visuals on graph paper. So I feel like I've got something in common with the creator of Impossible Mission.
So that it was originally written for the Commodore 64. Was that what you were playing it on?
Yeah. We owned my dad bought us a Commodore 64 in, I think, late 83. My neighbour had one as well, so that was great because you instantly double the number of games that you have access to.
So I mentioned in the intro that you grew up out in Greater Manchester, a place called Cheadle-Hume, is that right?
Cheadle-Hume, yeah.
What was that like?
Very middle class, very quiet and very safe. I suppose that I was a child of the 80s and my parents were just, it's that cliche of like, I'd leave the house, at the weekend, I would leave the house at 9 a.m. and my parents would expect me back for tea. And we would just go out on our bikes and just ride around the whole neighbourhood. It was very leafy, sleepy.
Like the Goonies.
Yes, exactly like the Goonies, except, yeah, at no point did we find a pirate ship, unfortunately. But yeah, it was really nice. It was a really nice place to grow up, very quiet, but it was very culturally insular. So my next door neighbor was Asian and it was weird. I'd like experienced my first, I had my first experience of racism vicariously
right.
through some of the things that he witnessed. And it was an extremely kind of white area. So I felt kind of culturally cut off from the world in some ways. Me and my neighbor were really, really into hip hop and electronic music and like everybody else in my area were like really into the Smiths.
Into Wagner.
Yeah. And kind of Germanic marching music. So yeah, I felt quite alone in a lot of ways, especially when I was at school. I really didn't fit in and I spent all of my time in the library on the BBC computer. Or I was in chess club and physics club, that can tell you that I was not on the top of the social strata, let's put it that way. So I was quite lonely, like really into, you know, really into computers, really into electronic culture, you know, reading Neuromancer and listening to Kraftwerk and Run DMC and but no one else was.
I think everyone's got a very clear picture of the young Keith Stewart now, Keith.
Yeah.
So you mentioned getting a Commodore 64 when you were quite young. I mean, those were early days, right? And your dad, you've written before, was into video games. He owned a Mega Drive and all of that. Would you play games together?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So he was really good because like it wasn't a situation that a lot of kids had where they had to convince their parents to get a home computer for homework. My dad was really into the idea straight away. We had a ZX81. Before the Commodore 64, and all of us, it was really weird, all of us as a whole family sat around the ZX81 programming basic games together, like a family gathered. It's like gather around the wireless on a Sunday evening, but we were typing in basic code into a ZX81, taking it in turns to put the lines in. You know, obviously we reached the limits of that pretty quickly. So my dad was like straight out to buy a Commodore 64, and I'm really glad he had a friend that advised him to, because I remember really trying to convince him to buy an Auric Atmos that I'd seen in the window of Dixon's because it came with 4 games. And I thought, 4 games? I can play 4 games immediately. This is the computer we need. And luckily, my dad didn't listen to me. So we got a Commodore 64 and we used to play leaderboard together, the famous golf game, really beautiful golf game. We played a lot of that together. We played the football game, lots of football games together, kickoff and things like that. Lots of sports games, the summer games, winter games, all those epics games. So,
what was his work to get him so interested in computers?
He was a buyer at NatWest, so he purchased stationery for the whole of the NatWest in the UK. But he had early access to computers at work.
Right, got it.
He was really interested in technology, and he used to bring home old calculators and old reel-to-reel tape machines for me from work so that I could take them to pieces when I was little. And that's how I got really into, like, how do these things work? What's inside them? You know, and it was that natural, I think, that natural inclination to take things apart and know what's inside them that really served me well at Edge magazine, I think.
Yeah, it's quite a it's quite a sort of geekish childhood in the sense that you're doing, you know, playing chess and, you know, taking apart machines and all that. But you wanted to, I think, go and, you know, you study drama and go into English, which is, you know, could typically attract maybe a different kind of kid. So how did that all happen? And what did you want to go and become an actor when you were a teenager?
I went through a stage of wanting to be an actor, like, because I felt so isolated at school. I was used to feel like that. But then I took drama, I think, in the fourth year because I just wanted to take another. I wanted to take as many arts things as I could. And when I got there, I realized when we started drama, all of the social barriers that I'd experienced up until that point disappeared. Everybody in that group, everybody in the drama group were friends. We felt like colleagues. You know, when you're putting on plays together or even just like doing improvisational sessions together, you immediately get that sense of camaraderie. And so like four or five of like the toughest boys in school took drama just because they thought it'd be a DOS. But it turns out they were really good actors. and I got on with them because of that. So that was really good. So I'd suddenly gone from being at the bottom of the social pool to at last having...
To like, having some tough guy minions.
Yes. Yeah. To having like being in the Goodfellas. Suddenly as well, the fact that, like video games, it's that kind of interconnection with your imagination and being able to express yourself in ways that you can't when you're quite an insular, kind of idiosyncratic child. Drama like video games is a form of self-expression. Like, because, you know, it's disguised. It's not really you. You're role playing. So yeah, I found it really, really useful. So yeah, when I went on and did drama at degree level, I did for a while want to be an actor, but I realized that I didn't want to spend like the next 20 years of my life waiting tables, which is what would have happened, I suspect.
Right. Let's come to your second game then. So this is from 1998. Tell us about this one.
This game is Half-Life. You're playing a kind of nerdy research engineer who begins a new job at the Black Mesa Research Facility that are doing experiments using this weird alien crystal that they found. And you arrive just on the day where the experiments are kicking off. The experiment goes hideously wrong, which leads to a what they call in the game a resonance cascade, which I think is like the most beautiful massive explosion in video games. Such a wonderful name. It sounds like an Orb album or a Pink Floyd song or something. Resonance cascade happens, opens a portal to an alien planet, aliens pour through, all hell breaks loose, almost everybody dies apart from you and a few scientists, and you have to get out of this Black Mesa research facility by clambering to the top. It's like built into this mountain, so you've got to get to the top and get out, but everything's against you. Alien monsters, the Marine Corps raid the building and need to kill everyone because they need to cover up this has ever happened. And it's just a gigantic, nightmarish, thrilling adventure. underground.
It has this amazing intro, doesn't it, where you take the tram, don't you, into the Black Mesa facility. And it was so unusual at that time in 1998, because most, first-person shooters like this begin with, it's a billion aliens, just use your shotguns, I think. And here you are taking a tram ride. It was really incredible.
It was so immersive. And I think that's what was so amazing about Half-Life. It was just a total immersion of it. I can remember Gabe Newell, who founded Valve, he was saying about shooting video games at the time just felt like rifle ranges. It just felt like you as a player was standing there like picking off plastic tin ducks at a fairground. And he wanted it to be an immersive cinematic experience that pulled you right in. So this entry where you're coming in on this kind of monorail is like, it's a narrative introduction to the world. It's an immersive introduction to the world. It's an introduction to your own character, because while you're moving along, you can actually navigate and move around in this space and look through windows. And as you're looking through the windows, you can see scientists outside going about their business and doing experiments. So it's just this incredible kind of transportive introduction. And it tells you a lot of the rules of the world before you've even stepped out into the world.
Right, right.
And I just thought, that's so good. It's so good. And the whole game's like that. There's no cutscenes. Any exposition happens on the fly. The immersion is never broken. It's just the set pieces are so exciting. And there's such a great sense of materiality and actually being there in this kind of broken laboratory, which is slowly disintegrating around you as these aliens burst out of the walls and out of pipes, and the head crabs, these horrible kind of face hugger like things that attach themselves onto the heads of scientists and turn them into these walking, screaming zombies. It's just the imagination of every set piece in the game is just wonderful.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right, Keith, let's come back to your story then. So you graduate, decide not to become an actor because you don't want to wait tables, and you end up at this studio, Big Red Software. Were you hoping to make games then? Is that where you applied?
No, it was more that my best friend... So I have to go back a bit and say that I did actually have another friend at school, a guy called John Cartwright, who is also a nerd. We didn't really know each other that well at school, but we kind of started to hit it off just as I was about to leave, because I left Chile U and moved to Hampstead. And for some reason, I only really got friendly with John right at the end. But then we kept writing to each other. Weirdly, John did always want us going to games. He programmed the Dragon 32 games that I designed. So he actually got a job in Leamington Spa while I was there as a student living in Leamington Spa. So we ended up in the same town. He was working for Big Red Software and I was at university. And during my summer holidays at Warwick, he said, why don't you come and work for us, write some of our documents, do some game testing. So that's kind of how I got into it. And when I left university, I had no idea what to do. And he said, well, come work for us. We're working on this game called Tank Commander. We need someone to do some stuff for that. And then we're going to be doing Big Red Racing, and we'll definitely need some testing and some documents written. So I just stayed there for a year because I didn't really know what else to do.
Sure, yeah.
But I loved it. There was only six of us, and we were working in this tiny little office above a printing shop in Leamington, and we were making games and we were playing games constantly. We played through all of the Lucasfilm adventures together. And it was just like, it was just really good fun. It was like a year off, really, like a gap year. But a gap year with a bunch of nerds in a small office in Leamington rather than Thailand.
Well, and you do, after a year, you moved to Bath to join Future Publishing. And you're one among that first cohort of writers on Edge magazine, working under its founding editor, Jason Brooks. What was that atmosphere like when you arrived?
It was weird because I actually started as writer. That was my first job there. And the old writer was going, Jim Flynn, he was going off to join PC Gamer in the US. They just launched PC Gamer over there and he was going to join in. And he was like, good luck, as he was packing his desk. And I was thinking, oh my God, what have I walked into? And it's kind of chaotic. At the time, there was just me, Nick Harper, production editor, and Jason Brooks on editorial. And immediately I was kind of expected to write like 25 pages a month. And I was just chucked into the deep end.
Wow.
Jason Brooks was he was brilliant. He was a really chaotic character who had an incredible vision for what he wanted and didn't really suffer people that didn't know what they were doing. So the first day I got there, he was expecting me, I think it might have been Virtua Fighter. He wanted me to take screenshots of Virtua Fighter. I had no idea how to do that. I had no idea the setup and how you had to take them on the Mac next to the Sega Saturn. And I basically had to learn it all that afternoon. And it was really tricky. I just moved to Bath alone, living with a landlord I didn't know. And I remember getting home that night and just thinking, what have I done? Because it was just a baptism of fire. As much as like joining a video game magazine can be, but it's really hard. But then like Jason realized I knew what I was doing and that I was a decent enough writer. And then it all kind of clicked into place. And like Edge during the mid 90s, it was like the absolute best place to be in game journalism, I think. You know, PlayStation was taking off. Saturn was still good. 3DO was there. We had legacy machines still, Neo Geo, PC Engine still hooked up in the Edge Games room. The first glimpses of the Ultra 64, which had obviously become the Nintendo 64. But it was just really exciting. There were so many machines, both from the past and coming in the future. There was a lot of kind of antagonism and jealousy about Edge in some ways. Like everyone thought we were completely up ourselves and they were frustrated that we'd get all the news first. So at Future, there was a big shared server where you had to place all your magazine documents before they went to the printers. And we'd have other magazines trying to sneakily look into our documents to look at our news to see what our stories were that were being run. So we had to misname all of our documents so people couldn't find them.
No way.
It was bizarre. Yeah.
Spy stuff.
Yes, but within the same company. It was hilarious. But yeah, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. And I was lucky that, you know, I was there with like amazing writers.
Edge has always had a more modest readership than some of the official magazines. But I, you know, like as you say from the anecdote, it's kind of had a disproportionately large impact, I think, on the industry, you know, in part because of its quality, but also I think because Jason did a lot of work in those early years establishing the magazine's reputation, both here and in Japan and all of that. And were you a part of that? Did you ever go over to Japan with him to sort of fly the flag of Edge among some of these companies?
Jason had that pretty much sewn up. And Jason had a Tokyo correspondent that he dealt with like on a daily basis. But Jason also made close friendships with Japanese game designers in a way that like no one else really could. And I can, like, there are several occasions that I can remember that Tetsuya Mizuguchi, the creator of Rez, came to visit us.
Previous guest of the podcast?
Yes. Yeah, he came to visit a few times and he'd go clubbing with Jason. And so Jason just said this had this rapport with game developers, whoever it was, and they were happy to tell him stories. But I kind of was really good with like the UK developers. I established lots of relationships with like UK developers who were just coming up on the scene. So I got to know Peter Molyneux really early in my career, people like that. I knew a lot of the people at Paul Frog who went on to join other companies. So I kind of established really good relationships with people that were going to be important over the next two or three years. a new core design. So, you know, that proved useful when they were showing off the first MLU sort of Tomb Raider. And so, yeah, I was better at establishing relationships in the UK. And then in the US, when I started going to E3, which is about 97, 98, those were fun trips.
We lost Jason a few years ago. I never met him, but he was clearly very warmly loved by people. Well, what impact did he have on your life? I suppose in terms of the way that he saw video games, did that influence you?
Hugely, yeah. He had a massive influence on me. Like, so there's two things there. He had an influence on me as a writer because he was the first person that really employed me as a writer and took my writing seriously and helped me craft my writing. Like, his thing was always obsession and detail. Those were the qualities he brought to his writing. You could tell that he loved what he was writing about. He knew everything about it. And he exuded that. He knew how to write about games in a way that both the people that made them and the people that really didn't know them that well could both appreciate. And that is unimaginably difficult, but that's what he did. And he created this atmosphere edge of just creativity and tension and excitement that, you know, I'd never experienced in a workplace before. And the way he thought about games, he interpreted them and read them like great works of literature. He interrogated video games. And, you know, in those days when we'd get 35mm slides sent to us by Japanese arcade manufacturers, instead of screenshots being emailed, they'd come to us on 35mm slides. So he'd, like, every day I'd come in and he'd be hunched over a light box looking at these slides and really, really analysing them. And every screenshot you see, if you open up a copy of Edge magazine that he edited, every screenshot in that magazine was handpicked by him out of 30 or 40 or 50 other screenshots. He was an absolute perfectionist. And that definitely inspired my writing, and that ability to communicate that passion in an intelligent, thoughtful, lively, interesting way that inspired, like, my game journalism, but also novel writing as well. So another guy who worked at the magazine called Simon Cox, who was a big friend of Jason's, and they lived together in San Francisco when they were both working on magazines there. He got married a few years ago, about 5 years ago, and Jason came to the wedding. And I can remember sitting with Jason at the table and just sort of saying to him, I said to him, like, you completely changed my life. And I know it's such a cliche thing to say, but I just needed to tell him that, like, the direction I went in with my life was pretty much all the way down to him and the faith that he showed in me. I'm so glad I got to tell him, because I didn't see him again. And the next time that we all gathered together was his funeral. And I think back to then, it would have been so easy for me not to tell him, but I'm so glad I did. I'm so glad he knew that. Because, yeah, I'm not sure that I could have really made it as a writer if it wasn't for him. So just his vision and his love of what he was doing and his knowledge and his charm. Yeah. Fantastic man.
Amazing tribute, Keith. Let's come to your third game. So this is from 2011. Another thing that's had a big impact on your life, I'd say. Tell us about this game.
So this is, of course, Minecraft. Thank you. for anyone that's not played it, the easiest way to think of it is digital Lego. Basically, it generates a world for you, a 3D world, and you inhabit that world as a blocky character. In that world, you can do pretty much what you want. You can build stuff, you can mine for resources, you can make things, you can explore the world, you can go out with a sword and attack zombies or creepers, or you can become a farmer, or you can just build, you can make machines. It's just, it's the kind of the ultimate permissive space in terms of video games. Like, there's nothing you can't do in that game. And every time you start it, you can think, oh, I might make a roller coaster today, or I might make an underground Bond lair. And that's the kind of game it is. You're restricted only by what you feel you want to do or can do in a, in a virtual space.
I'm not going to ask you too many questions about Minecraft now, because I think we're going to come to it a little bit later in your story again. So why don't we park Minecraft for a moment?
Okay.
And I'd like to come to the bit of your career where you come to join the Guardian, right? Which you'd been editing the DC UK magazine, which God rest the Dreamcast, but I guess the Dreamcast didn't make it, so neither did the magazines around it.
No.
And then, you join The Guardian a couple of years after that. Mainstream publications has kind of flirted with games coverage up until that point, but The Guardian, I think, was the first, you know, really major newspaper to hire a beat reporter, essentially, to cover games. Did you feel like a bit of an interloper in those days? And also, how did you, tell us how you came to join them as well?
So I started freelancing for them, and it came about because I was writing about, after I left DCUK, I started writing about mobile games because no one else was writing about them. This was like 2001. You know, they weren't thought of as a thing. And at the time, they were mostly SMS-based or running on WAP, which was the mobile version of the internet. And they were really basic, but I knew there was something there. Like, I understood immediately, this is going to be huge. So I started writing about them, and I just pitched a news piece to Jack Schofield, who was then the editor of The Guardian's online section. And by online section, I mean it was actually a section of the newspaper, the print newspaper called Online. Right. And he was editing that, and I said that mobile gaming is going to be the next big thing. I promise you, can I write about it? And he was like typical Jack Schofield, it's a new thing. So he said, yeah, write us a piece. And then I did that, and then kept pitching. And then eventually, I think in 2003, Guardian got really into blogging, and they wanted to set up a games blog. And the head of the blogging, the online section, then Neil McIntosh, who's now heading up the BBC's online presence, he saw that I was doing online mobile game stuff, so he invited me to go along and be part of the games blogging team with, and also one of the other people there was Greg Howson, who was a games journalist at the time, and also Alex Kotowski, who was one of the presenters of Bits and Thumb Bandits, and she joined as well. So it was us three, and we ran the Guardian games blog, and it was fascinating because we were working on a national newspaper. And we had no editors. We were writing stuff we wanted and immediately posting it to the Guardian's website, which is crazy. Yeah, it was so dangerous. And so we were just writing what we wanted. And it became clear very quickly that I wasn't just going to write about mobile games. Basically we were all writing about whatever we wanted, whatever was happening at the time. And it was so fun and so free. And the interesting thing was the Guardian was like invested enough in video games that they wanted us there, but not invested enough that they wanted to know what we were doing. So we were just like running our own little online fanzine really about video games. It was brilliant. And then eventually, the whole blogging phase started to die down, but Guardian was still interested in coverage. So I said, right, I'll take on the coverage, and I'll write it all online, and I'll write stuff on print as well. And Jemima Kish at the time was technology editor, employed me as games editor, and I was the first ever games editor in a mainstream national newspaper. So that's Jemima Kish is another person I owe so much to, because she was like, no, you've got to stay, you've got to keep doing this is really important, we've got to be on top of this.
She now heads up the Guardian's US coverage, is that right, or did for a while?
She left that. She's doing lots of San Francisco style stuff now, but she was for a while, but not anymore.
I suppose, having come up through the a future publishing and the specialist press, you know, there's a certain kind of way of writing about games, you know, for Edge and all of that. And, you know, I suppose you're now speaking to a slightly different audience, you know, a bit like you were saying with Jason, being able to write to people who maybe don't really care about games or who have only got a passing interest or something. How were you trying to set the tone of the kind of things that you'd cover or your voice, you know, in order to be both knowledgeable and authoritative, but also, you know, welcoming to anyone passing by?
Yeah, I studied quite a lot of what Jack Schofield and Vic Keegan were doing in the online section, how they wrote about technology and how they covered things like the Consumer Electronics Show in the US and how they wrote about, you know, PCs, everything in the technological space at that time, the internet, how they wrote about the internet. And I kind of merged that with my Edge sensibilities of in-depth coverage for intelligent, interested, but not necessarily always wildly knowledgeable people. And I just kind of merged those two styles together. And what I desperately wanted to do was kind of make a credible space for games journalism within a national newspaper, because at that point, you know, most games coverage was let's ban this sick filth or children wasting their lives looking at screens. And I managed to, The Guardian was never really into that stuff, but I created a space where it couldn't really happen anymore, even if they wanted to on The Guardian, because we were running good, positive games coverage and, you know, interesting in-depth stuff. So we couldn't really ever go down that route ever again of scare stories, because it just wouldn't have fitted with what we were doing. So yeah, I think that was part of it. And I really wanted games to be considered part of the cultural landscape. So even though we were still in the technology department at that time, I really wanted to marry games with the other things that Guardian readers were interested in, you know, film, television, music, art, theatre. So I tried to write in those terms as well. And I was always comparing games and the impact of games with other art forms, sometimes to like ludicrous lengths, just because I like trolling people. But like, one of my favourite things I ever wrote was comparing Lorde's song Green Light with Sonic the Hedgehog and how they were structured. And they were structured in very idiosyncratic, unorthodox ways. And that was one of my favourite things. I did a piece about how video games could learn from the neuromantic movement of the early 80s. I just really loved those kind of juxtapositions, because I knew that they annoyed a lot of people.
Well, I was going to say, and maybe this is something that we can't talk about, so just say, but this did get you in trouble one time with one of the art critics for The Guardian. Is that something you can go on public record about?
Yeah, I could do that.
Tell us what happened.
Well, Jonathan Jones, the respected, much-loved, avuncular art critic for The Guardian, had written a piece essentially talking about how video games could never really be considered art, how it was a lesser form. And so I took exception to this and I wrote a piece basically, you know, chastising him and calling to question his intellectual credentials.
Oh, gosh.
In terms of how he understood art and what it was. And you know, and it was quite a blistering piece. I'm quite surprised. Like Jemima Kish always said to me, like when I said, should I do this? She always said, you know, that classic thing, do it now, apologize later. And, but I only did 50% of that. So yeah, I wrote this piece and he was very, very cross about it and kicked up a little bit of a fuss in the paper and then turned up. I don't think he'll ever confirm this, but I'm quite sure he turned up in the comments as well and had a bit of a four-letter tirade against me. But it's absolutely fine. I'm sure it's water under the bridge now.
Well, and didn't you both get called into the headmaster's office?
Well, Jemima managed to keep me out of that.
Okay.
But no, I didn't make it that far. I think Jemima talked to the... She was like the sixth form head and she talked to the headmaster on my behalf. I didn't even get lines. I got away.
It'd be funny if they'd made you lines. Video games are not art.
Yeah.
Write it out 1,000 times. Keep shit.
Yes. And then send it to Jonathan.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But no, I got away with that. Yeah.
That's good. All right, Keith, let's come to your fourth game. So this is from 2014. Tell us about this one.
This is The Sims 4. The Sims is a series of video games that are kind of part interior design app, part virtual soap opera, part pet sim. And they've been going since, I think, 2000, the first one came out. Originally designed by Will Wright, who wrote SimCity. You build a house and then you inhabit it with Sims, AI, intelligent characters. And then you can do with them what you want. They can get careers. They can loaf about at home eating pizza and soiling themselves. They can get into relationships. They can fulfill themselves through art. And it's totally open-ended. You can't win. You are essentially experimenting with what it means to be a human being at home. And I just find it utterly fascinating. I absolutely love it. And I got most of the add-ons. My favourite add-on of the last couple of years was the English Village add-on.
Oh, wow.
So you could make... It's so good. You could make your house look like a little cottage.
And then have a suspicious murder that someone has to come over.
Yeah. 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 And I have a little detective sim come along.
Richard Osman turns up.
Yeah. Right, yeah, this is right, cozy crime in your living room. You don't know how he got there or why he's there. What I love about it is that it has this community. There's such a creative community of people that use mods and use all of the add-ons to create their own stories and their own narratives. Ever since the first one arrived in the office, it arrived in the Edge office in 2000, and we created a house of Sims based on everybody at Edge.
Oh, wow.
and we were all we ever tried to do was make the art editor wet himself in the kitchen. that was the ultimate aim for us, bullying the art editor. But he's fine because he was a terrible trickster and he played terrible tricks on us. You'd never guess this from Edge magazine. So, such a serious mag, but behind the scenes, we have this terrible prankster who is our art editor. And he used to play terrible tricks on us all. And so Sims was our way of,
that was your
of
revenge.
Getting back at him. Can I tell you one thing he did to me? I had this one of those like pen pots on my desk. One of those like multiple little pen pots where you could put your pens in and your rubber and your pencil sharpener. He forced a block of cheese down inside my pen, the pen one, really deep down so I couldn't see it. And it was there for months. And every day I'd come in and I had just this terrible smell of cheese everywhere. And I couldn't work it out what it was. And I was becoming really self-conscious about it. And I'd catch him for days sniggering at me. And then eventually he came over and
chipped it over.
Emptied out my pen pot. And there was this moldy bit of cheese at the bottom. Anyway, Sims 4, great game. What I love about it as well, Will Wright designed it around this idea, and it was an architect, I think named Christopher Alexander, who had this idea about how environmental design influences behavior. He was an architect that believed that how you designed your environment was essentially created who you were as a person and how you behaved. And The Sims was a way to investigate and analyze this theory.
Right.
So it's quite an intellectual game. But what I love about it is the contrast with how people played it.
Right.
And how people would murder their Sims in swimming pools or create factories of dungeon-based artists in their in their cellars who would have to crank out art which you could then sell to build new bits onto your house. And people would have these kind of horrible sweatshops of artists working in their cellars. I love it. I just think it's just endlessly enjoyable creative space.
So, Keith, it's a piece you wrote for The Guardian in 2015 that led to your first novel, A Boy Made of Blocks. Tell us what happened. How did you come to write the book?
I'd read a piece about Minecraft, and it was kind of a bit... I'd read it in another newspaper. I was kind of a bit sniffy about the whole thing and kind of very critical of Minecraft and what it was. And it was I was in the Guardian office waiting to get my train home. My train had been delayed, so I thought I'd just write a quick blog post about Minecraft and actually how it had helped me. My son, Zach, was about 7 or 8 when Minecraft came out on the Xbox, which was like 2013. And he'd just been diagnosed with autism. And he struggled to express himself verbally or creatively. Like, he was no good at, he couldn't draw. He wasn't very good at drawing. He wasn't very good at conversation, very limited vocabulary, really struggling to communicate. And I played Minecraft and I just thought, hang on, there's something here that I think he's really going to engage with. And so I took it home and I played it with him. And I often say, and it's so true, It was like that classic cliche about a light bulb switching on in his head. It was like neurons were exploding in his brain. Like, things, it woke up something in him, this video game. Being able to explore this really safe environment, safe, predictable environment with lots of interesting variables, but underpinned with logic, where he was an avatar, but also a kind of a god. He was in control and had agency. All of these things that we almost take for granted were miracles to him. And he started playing it and building houses, these kind of weird, ramshackle, Texas Chainsaw Massacre-like houses, and sharing them to us and learning words so that he could explain to us about what he'd made and show us what he'd made. You know, learning the words for all of the minerals and resources in the video game. Like, I always found it was incredible. Like, he went from having like a 50-word vocabulary to be able to say things like obsidian in the correct context. And so, yeah, this game fundamentally changed his life. And so I'd written this article about that and not really thought much about it. And then I went home that night, and by the time I got home, it had been viewed 250,000 times, and it was just going up and up and up. Just this story that I'd written because my train was late. Oof. About my son and Minecraft. And there's just hundreds and hundreds of comments from people saying, this is me, this is my life, this is my son, this is me on the autism spectrum, this is my experience. And from that, an editor at Sphere called Edward, who also has an autistic son, he saw that story and he was looking for a new kind of family drama novel written by a man from a man's perspective. You know, I think Nick Hornby had kind of moved on, Tony Parsons had moved on from that genre, and they were looking for something new. And he thought this story was modern and interesting. And so I went for a meeting with him, and he asked me if I'd ever considered writing a novel, and I said no. And he essentially talked me into it over a meeting to try and write a novel based on my experiences with my son and with Minecraft, but totally fictionalized. Like, neither of us had an interest in writing a personal memoir or anything. And that's how it came about.
Extraordinary.
And he guided me through the whole process.
Yeah, and you wrote it in a year, didn't you? It was quite a brisk period.
Yeah, 10 incredibly intense months. And it was a real gamble for him. And he was actually surprised, I think, that it did work out.
I hope he told you that later, not during the process.
Yeah, he did. Yes, he didn't. He knows how massively fragile I am, so he wouldn't have done that.
And as you say there, your son Zach was pretty young at the time when that came out. Now he's in his late teens. Does he know about the book? And how does he feel about it?
Yeah, he's good. He knows about it. He's actually read it now. Well, he tells me he's read it. I don't know. But he knows, he definitely knows about it. He's very pleased with it. I think he's quite proud of it because other people that he knows have read it. Like, some of his teachers have read it. And so I think that's kind of helped him, especially when he was in, you know, mainstream education. He had a couple of teachers that knew about it and could talk to him about it. So I think that kind of helped him in a way feel a bit more grounded and a bit more accepted that, you know, he had this book that was kind of written about him. And yeah, he's always been kind of comfortable with it. And I did talk to him where I can remember going on a walk with him when he was like 7 and saying, do you mind if Daddy writes this book? And it's not about you, but it's about some of the things that have happened to us. And right from the beginning, Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I don't know what I would have done if he'd have said no.
Yeah.
But luckily, I'll never find out.
Put phone up, Ed, and go, sorry, the whole thing's off.
Yeah, Zach says no.
All right, Keith, let's come to your fifth and your final game. Excited about this. First time it's been picked, unbelievably, from 2022. What's the game?
The game is Elden Ring. Directed by Miyazaki, who directed and created the Dark Souls games and Demon Souls. So I was never really into those games. I've never been a Souls-aphile. Like, I just kind of bounced off them. I found them like too obtuse and difficult and complex and nightmarish, which is ironic because I work now, the new games editor at The Guardian, well, not new, she's been there for like 5 years, but Keza McDonald co-wrote a book about Dark Souls, so she is very much team From Software. But Elden Ring came in, it just so happened she was working on something else, so I took it on to review, and just immediately fell for it. And I think because it's open world, it meant that I could run away from the baddies really easily. Like, I was never in there. You know, Dark Souls creates all of these very constricted kind of Piranesi style dungeons where it's inescapable and you are going to get clobbered to death and you've got to beat that one monster before you can continue. Whereas I spent a lot of my time in Limgrave, which is the first area of Elden Ring, just like wandering around and trying to stay out of trouble and trying to assess what was going on. And the world is just so incredibly rich and weird and surreal, and it has like characters with bizarre, incredibly similar names wandering this landscape of like death and beauty, with these kind of bloody skylines, the weird bloody skies, or, you know, some places had these kind of almost nightmarish, hellish, Dante-esque feel about them, and other places like bathed in beautiful autumnal sunshine. And it was just these surreal, hypnotic, almost woozy differences in the world that made it really interesting to explore. And it's just peopled with these bizarre characters, Morgott the Grease Given and Malkieth the Black Blade.
They're kind of old Testament names, aren't they, almost?
They are. And it has this, it has a real kind of folk horror mythology feel to it. And I don't know if this is George R.R. Martin was involved in the writing, but the story is essentially about a group of warring demigod siblings whose godlike queen mother dies and leaves this kingdom in disarray. And you have these kind of sociopathic aristocrats, incestuous maniacs fighting over this kingdom. And it feels just like Tudor England, but like writ large.
The House of Lords.
Yeah. And I love the fact that what I specifically love about the story is the narrative is something that happens in the background and you have to find it and interpret it with the help of other people who are playing at the same time as you. There's no push note. There's like push notifications in this game. You know, it doesn't vomit lore drops at you every 5 seconds. It doesn't make you watch countless inescapable cinematic sequences. It's the story is there in the background, but it's more of a mythology than a narrative. And and it's a very subtle difference, but it makes a world of difference when you're playing a video game to feel like you're in this world where things are happening that you can't control or understand, and you are surrounded by these characters with specialist arcane knowledge that you don't have. It's just such a magical experience wandering this landscape. It feels like a sort of surreal Czechoslovakian 1970s animation. And I just like everywhere you go, whether it's like Volcano Manor or at this weird Gothic castle somewhere, it's just full of interesting ideas. Just so replete with imagination. I love it. And it's so complicated. It's ridiculously complicated. I don't understand the systems. I've played that game for 400 hours and I still don't really understand.
How to blog.
Yeah, I don't. I never blog, Simon. I don't.
Still in the starting area.
Yeah. I got so stuck on one boss. I can remember tweeting like guard to guard, basically to Guardian readers, like begging them for their help.
Someone come and help me.
Yeah, please. I bought the walkthrough book as well, which is a beautiful book, by the way. It's worth getting. But it's the first walkthrough I think I've bought since like the 80s. Yeah, I just love it. And the fact that you can interact with other players as well in this world, like wordlessly, I love that as well. And leave little messages for each other. It's just everywhere you look, everywhere you tread, there's going to be something there that's interesting.
Beautifully put, Keith. You should think about writing about video games, I think.
I might give it a thought. You know, when the acting doesn't pan out anymore.
Right, let's look at your console then, Keith. So we've got Impossible Mission, Half-Life, Minecraft, The Sims 4, and Elden Ring. Yes, mate.
Yes. Yes, that's going to keep anyone occupied for many, many years.
We need a name for your console, Keith. What would you like to call it?
I really wanted to call it Maths Bugger. Which was the first game I ever made myself.
Oh God! This console is going to be cancelled before it's even had its box designed.
If I'm allowed to do that, I'm allowed to do that.
Of course you are. Yeah.
Yes, that is the night title. It's the first game I ever made, and that is the title of my console, Maths Bugger.
It'll have to be, I suppose, for the US market, it'll have to be Math Bugger, but...
Yes. We'll have to get into that. I mean, yeah, the lawyers can sort that out. Yeah, it was a maths-based game, so it makes sense. I'm not just an idiot.
Yeah, no, sure.
But I feel like that's what I'm going to call it.
Wonderful. Oh, gosh. Right.
You already regret this, don't you?
Yeah, just cancel. We won't put this out now. brilliant. All right, Keith, well... Yeah, you know, I don't want to be too sappy, but yeah, I'm just so glad to be your friend and I'm cheering you on in all that you do and all of the best with... You've got the publication you booked next week, haven't you? So I hope it goes well.
Yeah, love is a curse. Yeah, thank you very much. And same beautiful feelings to you, Simon.
Thank you so much to my guest, Keith Stewart. Love is a Curse, the new book from Keith Stewart, is available in shops now. It came out about a week ago in the UK, I think. You can buy it on ebook if that's how you like to read your books. But of course, if you prefer a physical copy, then go down to your local bookshop and buy it there if you can. Your Waterstones, your Independent, whatever it is, I'm sure you've got a bookshop near where you live. And if you want, let's try and keep supporting them, basically, so that you can have that long into the future. Keith's written a few books, as we talked about there. I've enjoyed all of his books very much. For those of you listening to this podcast who are particularly interested in video games, then I suggest you also read A Boy Made of Blocks, which we talked about there, of course, in that conversation. Keith's first book, all about Minecraft, which features heavily. It's a love story as well, and a story about fatherhood and being a parent, and a story about having a child with autism. But of course, Minecraft features lots too. So check out A Boy Made of Blocks. As I said there, I've known Keith for quite a few years. We first met properly, I think, in about 2011, 2012. We were both covering the same event in Los Angeles. It was an Activision event for Call of Duty. They hosted this big sort of lavish esports event. I don't even know if we were using the term esports at that point. We probably were. But anyway, it was a big sort of Call of Duty tournament. And they had some of the best teams coming from all around the world to compete. I think there was $100,000 prize money at stake. And this was right when Call of Duty was locked in a battle with EA's Battlefield series, and they were both trying to vie for dominance. And I think that's partly why Activision put on this huge lavish event and spent who knows how many millions of dollars on it. Anyway, they brought out a load of journalists, including some from the UK, and that's where I got to know Keith really well. I've got very abiding memories of that trip, because after the winners of the tournament had been crowned and announced, they sort of cleared the venue. I think it was the same venue that the tournament had happened in. Anyway, Kanye West turns up and played a concert. He was really at the height of his powers. His beautiful, dark, Twisted Fantasy album was out, the one with Power on it. And I think as well, he'd just done an album with Jay-Z together. Anyway, he did this concert, and I remember standing watching it from sort of where the sound booth area was, which we were allowed in, and it was all roped off, and Lindsay Lohan was standing next to us. I mean, this sounds like a dream, and it feels like a dream thinking back on it, but it did all happen. And then afterwards, we went on to some sort of specially arranged venue, probably on Sunset Strip somewhere, that they'd hired, and all of these sort of pasty little journalists from Europe in their mid-20s or whatever turned up at this Hollywood party, and they had sort of dancers all lining the walls, and yeah, it felt like a bit of a mismatch. Kanye had obviously been booked, probably part of his contract with Activision was that he turned up to this party for 20 minutes or something. Anyway, I remember him sitting in the roped off VIP area. It was a very small club, you know, the size of a couple of tennis courts or whatever. And also in the roped off area was the actor Terry Hatcher, who we all know from Superman of that era. And I remember I was with Keith, and he sort of said, "Oh, there's Terry Hatcher. I'd love to say hello to her." And him sort of shuffling up to the bodyguard type man who was manning that area and stopping anyone from getting in. And Keith very charmingly saying something in his ear, and the guy nodding and letting him go through. And I distinctly heard Keith lean down and introduce himself, shake her hand and say, "I love your work, Mrs. Thatcher." Yes, I knew we were going to be friends after that. I wasn't quite sure how that was going to go, because it's the first time I've interviewed a very, very close friend of mine. I talk to Keith all the time, and like I say, we hang out quite a lot, but you know, that went well, right? Really enjoyed that. Quite a lot of that stuff, certainly from Keith's early life, I didn't know about. Although I did, of course, know about his great love for Philip Larkin. I loved as well hearing Keith's tribute to Jason Brooks, the founding editor of Edge magazine. What a very special tribute that was. And I think, you know, like I said, it's sort of the generation or two before mine, that generation at Edge magazine, long before I started writing for them, Jason had left. But his influence on the mag is clear even today after he is gone. And so it was just great to hear the effect as well that Jason had on Keith's life and in setting his course. Thank you to those of you who tune in to the show every week. It's much appreciated. It's lovely to have you along for the ride. And I hope you've been enjoying the guests that I've had this year. It's been a great and eclectic lineup, I think, of people. Lots more where that has come from. We've got some really exciting conversations I'm looking forward to sharing with you. If you'd like a sneak preview of who's coming up each month, then consider becoming a Patreon supporter. It is a great way to support the show and help it keep going and all of that. So head to patreon.com/myperfectconsole and you'll get to hear your episodes early and ad free. You'll get heads up on who the guests are at the beginning of each month for that month. And also you'll get to, well, everyone can play along with my perfect game of the month. So that's a feature that we run where we all play a game together. But it's only the Patreon supporters who get the bonus episodes, which to date have all been with the brilliant comedian Glenn Moore. And he and I have been playing through the game along with you, the listeners, and then we discussed them. Last month was Stephen's sausage roll, and we had a lot of fun discussing that. It's a really enjoyable episode, I think. And you can, if you become a Patreon supporter, you can download that and have a listen, as well as to all the previous ones as well. And you also get to join the community and all of that kind of stuff. On the subject of my perfect game of the month, I am very pleased to announce that for May, we are playing through Earthbound, an absolute raging classic of the Super Nintendo era. It was released in Japan in 1994 under the name Mother. And then it came out in North America the following year in 1995. It was never released in Europe. And yet it has still been, you know, sort of its influence as a sort of cult classic is very, very well known. It's a well-regarded game. And we're going to have a lot of fun playing through this one, I think. It was picked by John Johannes, creative director for Tango Gameworks, who worked on, most recently, Hi-Fi Rush. And yes, John talked eloquently about the game, so go back, listen to that episode if you haven't. There are lots of different ways to play Earthbound, which do not involve having to pay $1,000 for an original copy. It's a very sought-after game. But you can also play it via emulation, all sorts of easy ways. I think you can play it in your browser, in fact, if you just search play Earthbound online, and it will come up with a little Super Nintendo emulator online and you can play it that way. Join us, play Earthbound. If you head to the Patreon page, and you'll be able to leave comments, all of that stuff is open to the public, so you'll be able to join in that way. But yeah, like I say, if you want to hear the bonus episode with Glenn, you'll have to become a supporter. John mentioned this a bit in our chat about the game, but it was designed by a chap called Shigesato Itoi, who is a sort of, John described him as a Renaissance man in that he's very accomplished in lots of different areas. He worked in advertising for a long time and sort of came up with some of the most famous sort of advertising slogans in Japan were Itoi's work. He also voiced one of the characters in the very famous Studio Ghibli film My Neighbor Totoro. He wrote a collection of short stories with the country's most successful novelist, Haruki Murakami. I think he's also co-written some songs with the Oscar-winning composer Ryuichi Sakamoto. So this is a person who has accomplished great things in sort of everything he touches, really. And Earthbound, as it was known in Japan, Mother 2, is certainly no exception. It's a very well-regarded classic video game. So we're going to have fun playing through that. If you've never played it before, and I'm sure lots of you haven't, this is a great chance to check out what all the fuss is about. And then, yes, next week, our guest is Teddy Deef. Teddy is a video game designer and writer who worked with the indie studio, probably best known as one of the founding members of the indie studio Heart Machine, which produced Hyper Light Drifter, one of the best regarded indie games of a few years ago. He then became a creative director at Square Enix Montreal, and most recently he's been working as creative director of We Are OFK, an episodic game about a fictional band in which he, which also has a real band attached to it that has been playing lots of concerts. And We Are OFK, this has happened after actually I interviewed Teddy, but it's been nominated for a Peabody Award, the very, very prestigious American Peabody Awards. And I think by the time the episode comes out, we may know whether We Are OFK has won a Peabody or not, but either way, amazing to have received that nomination. So we do get into all of that stuff, Teddy's life, his great experience and perspective on video games and video game making. So it's going to be a good episode, I can guarantee that. So yeah, I will be back again next week with Teddy, with five more games and one more perfect console. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.